We nodded. With no real sense of urgency, he pushed the call button for Nessus, a thing Speaker could not do. The puppeteer answered instantly, as if he had been waiting for the signal. Louis was surprised to see that Speaker remained on the line. Rapidly, he outlined what had happened.
"It appears that we were both wrong about Teela," said Nessus.
"Yeah."
"She is moving under emergency power. Her forehead would not be enough to activate the proper controls. First, she must manipulate the override slot. It is difficult to see how she could do that by accident."
"Where is it?" And when the puppeteer had shown him, Louis said, "She might have stuck her finger in it just out of curiosity."
"Really?"
Speaker interrupted Louis's answer. "But what can we do?"
"When she wakes up, have her signal me," Nessus said crisply. "I can show her how to go back on normal thrust and how to find us afterward."
"Meanwhile, we can do nothing?"
"That is correct. There is the danger that elements may burn out in the propulsion system. However, her vehicle will avoid obstacles. She will not crash. She is receding from us at Prox Mach 4. The worst danger she faces is anoxia, which can lead to brain damage. I suspect she is safe from that."
"Why? Anoxia is dangerous."
"She is too lucky," said Nessus.
Chapter 18. The Perils of Teela Brown. It was black night when they emerged from the iris of the ice storm. There were no stars, but faint blue arch light reached through an occasional break in the cloud cover. "I have reconsidered," Speaker said. "Nessus, you may rejoin us if you will."
"I will," said the puppeteer.
"We need your alien insights. You have demonstrated great ingenuity. You must understand that I will not forget the crime your species has committed against mine."
"I would not wish to tamper with your memory, Speaker."
Louis Wu hardly noticed this triumph of practicality over honor, intelligence over xenophobia. Where the cloud bank met the infinity horizon, he searched for the mark of Teela's vapor trail, but it had entirely disappeared. Teela was still unconscious. Her intercom image stirred restlessly, and Louis shouted, "Teela!" But she did not answer.
"We were wrong about her," said Nessus. "But I cannot understand why. Why should we have crashed if her luck is so powerful?"
"Exactly what I have been telling Louis."
"But," said the puppeteer, "if her luck has no power, how could she have activated the emergency thruster? I believe I was right from the first. Teela Brown has psychic luck."
"Then why was she picked in the first place? Why did the liar crash? Answer me."
"Stop it," said Louis.
They ignored him. Nessus was saying,
"Her luck is clearly undependable."
"If her luck had failed her just once, she would be dead."
"Were she dead or damaged, I would not have selected her. We must allow for coincidence," said Nessus. "You must remember, Speaker, that the laws of probability do provide for coincidence."
"But they do not provide for magic. I cannot believe in breeding for luck."
"You'll have to," said Louis.
This time they heard him. He continued,
"I should have known much earlier, not because she kept missing disasters. It was the little things, things in her personality. She's lucky, Speaker, believe it."
"Louis, how can you credit this nonsense?"
"She's never been hurt. Never."
"How can you know?"
"I know. She knew all about pleasure, nothing about pain. Remember when the sunflowers blasted you? She asked you if you could see. 'I'm blinded,' you said. She said, 'Yes, but can you see?' She didn't believe you. Then, oh, right after the crash, she tried to walk barefoot up a lava slope that was just short of melting hot."
"She is not very intelligent, Louis."
"She is intelligent, Tangit. She's just never been hurt. When she burned her feet, she charged straight down the slope onto a surface a dozen times more slippery than ice, and she never fell down."
"But you don't need details," said Louis. "All you've got to do is watch her walk. Clumsy. Every second it looks like she's going to fall over. But she doesn't. She doesn't knock things over with her elbows. She doesn't spill things or drop things. She never did. She never learned not to, don't you see? So she's not graceful."
"This would not be apparent to non-humans," Speaker said dubiously. "I must take your word for it, Louis. Still, how can I believe in psychic luck?" I do. I have to.
If her luck were dependable, said Nessus, she would never have tried to walk on recently molten rock. Yet the luck of Teela Brown does protect us sporadically. Reassuring, is it not? You three would be dead had not clouds shielded you when you crossed the sunflower field.
Yeah, said Louis.
But he remembered that the clouds had parted long enough to sear the skin of Speaker to animals. He remembered the stairs of heaven which had carried Teela Brown 9 flights upward, while Louis Wu had had to walk. He felt the bandages on his hand and remembered Speaker's hand charred to the bone, while Teela's translator burned in its saddle case.
Her luck seems to protect her somewhat better than it protects us, he said.
And why not? But you seem upset, Louis.
Maybe I am.
Her friends would long since have stopped telling her their troubles. Teela didn't understand troubles. Describing pain to Teela Brown would be like trying to describe color to a blind man.
Whiplash of the heart? Teela had never been thwarted in love. The man she wanted came to her and stayed until she had almost tired of him, then volunteered to go.
Sporadic or not, Teela's odd power made her a little different from human, perhaps. A woman, surely, but with different strengths and talents, and blind spots, too. And this was a woman Louis had loved. It was very odd.
She loved me, too, Louis mused. Strange. I'm not her type. And if she hadn't loved me, then...
What? Louis, are you speaking to me?
No, Nessus, I'm speaking to me.
Was that her real reason for joining Louis Wu and his motley crew?
Then the mystery was compounded. Luck made Teela fall in love with an unsuitable man, motivating her to join an expedition both uncomfortable and disastrous, so that she had several times brushed close to violent death. It didn't make sense.
Teela's intercom image looked up. Blank eyes and empty face. Puzzled. Filling suddenly with stark terror. Her eyes, wide and white, looking down. Teela's lovely oval face was ugly with insanity.
Easy, said Louis. Take it easy. Relax. You're all right now.
But...
A falsetto squeak was Teela's voice.
We're out of it. It's way behind us. Look behind you. Tanju, look behind you.
She turned. For a long moment, Louis saw only soft, dark hair. When she turned back, she had better control of herself.
Nessus, said Louis, tell her.
The puppeteer said, You have been moving at Mach 4 for more than half an hour. To bring your fly cycle back to normal speed, insert your index finger in the slot marked with a green rim.
Though still frightened, Teela was capable of following orders.
Now you must rejoin us. My signal indicates that your course has followed a curve. You are to port and spinward of us. As you have no indicator, I will have to guide you to us by ear. For the present, turn directly to anti-spinward.
Which way is that?
Turn left until you are aimed at one base of the arch.
I can't see the arch. I'll have to go above the clouds.
She seemed almost composed now.
Tanj, but she'd been frightened. Louis couldn't remember ever seeing anyone that frightened. Certainly he'd never seen Teela that frightened.
Had he ever seen Teela frightened?
Louis turned to look over his shoulder. The land was dark beneath the clouds, but the ice storm, a vast distance behind them, glowed blue in the arch light. It watched them go with total concentration and no sign of regret.
Louis was deep in his own thoughts when a voice spoke his name.
Yeah, he said.
Aren't you mad?
Mad? He thought about it. It occurred to him briefly that, by normal standards, she had done an incredibly stupid thing diving her cycle like that. And so he probed for anger as he would have probed for an old toothache. And he found nothing. Normal standards didn't fit Teela Brown. The tooth was dead.
I guess not. What did you see down there, anyway?
I could have been killed, Teela said with mounting anger. Don't shake your head at me, Louis Wu. I could have been killed. Don't you care?
Don't you?
She jerked back as if he'd slapped her. Then he saw her hand move, and she was gone. She was back a moment later. "There was a hole," she cried furiously, "and mist at the bottom. Well?"
"How big?"
"How should I know?" And she was gone again.
Right. How could she have guessed scale in that flickering neon light?
"She risks her own life," Louis thought, "then blames me for not getting angry. An attention-getting device? How long has she been doing it? Anyone else would die young with a habit like that."
"But not her," said Louis Wu. "Not..."
"Am I afraid of Teela Brown?
Or have I finally flipped?"
It had happened to others his age. A man as old as Louis Wu must have seen impossible things happen again and again. For such a man, the line between fantasy and reality sometimes blurred. He might become ultra-conservative, rejecting the impossible even after it had become fact. Like Cragen Perrell, who would not believe in the thruster drive because it violated the second law of motion. Or he might believe anything. Like Zero Hale, who kept buying fake slaver relics. Either way lay ruin and madness.
No. When Teela Brown escapes certain death by banging her head on a fly-cycle dashboard, that's more than coincidence.
But why did the liar crash? A silver fleck edged between Louis and the smaller silver fleck to spinward.
"Welcome back," said Louis.
"Thank you," said Nessus.
He must have used emergency thrust to catch up so fast. Speaker had issued his invitation only 10 minutes ago. Two triangular heads, small and transparent, considered Louis from above the dash.
"I feel safe now. When Teela joins us in half an hour, I will feel safer still."
"Why?"
"The luck of Teela Brown shields us, Louis."
"I don't think so," said Louis Wu.
Speaker, silent, watched them both in the intercom. Only Teela was out of the circuit.
"Your arrogance bothers me," said Louis Wu. "Breeding for a lucky human was arrogant as the devil. You've heard of the devil?"
"I have read of the devil in books."
"Snob. But your stupidity is worse than your arrogance. You blithely assume that what's good for Teela Brown is good for you. Why should it be?"
Nessus sputtered. Then, "Surely this is natural. If we are both enclosed by the same spacecraft hull, a rupture is bad luck for both of us."
"Sure, but suppose you're passing a place where Teela wants to go, and suppose you don't want to land. A drive failure just then would be lucky for Teela, but not for you."
"What nonsense, Louis! Why would Teela Brown want to go to the ring world? She never knew it existed until I told her so."
"But she's lucky. If she needed to come here without knowing it, she'd come here anyway. Then her luck wouldn't be sporadic, would it, Nessus? It would have been working all the time. Lucky that you found her. Lucky that you didn't find anyone else who qualified. All those bad phone connections, remember?"
"But..."
"Lucky that we crashed.
Remember how you and Speaker argued over who was in charge of the expedition?
Well, now you know."
"But why?"
"I don't know."
Louis raked his fingernails across his scalp in utter frustration. His straight black hair had grown out to the length of a crew cut, excluding the queue.
"Does the question upset you, Louis? It upsets me. What could be here on the ring world to attract Teela Brown? This place is unsafe. Strange storms and badly programmed machinery and sunflower fields and unpredictable natives all threaten our lives."
"Ha!" Louis barked. "Right, that's part of it, at least. Danger doesn't exist for Teela Brown, don't you see? Any assessment we make of the ring world has to take that into account."
The puppeteer opened and closed his mouths several times in rapid succession.
"Does make things difficult, doesn't it?" Louis chortled.
For Louis Wu, solving problems was a pleasure in itself.
"But it's half the answer. If you assume..."
The puppeteer screamed. Louis was shocked. He had not expected the puppeteer to take it so badly. The puppeteer wailed in two tones, then, without apparent haste, he tucked his heads under himself. Louis saw only the straggly mane that covered his brain case. And Teela was on the intercom.
"You've been talking about me,"
she said without heat. She was unable to hold a grudge, Louis realized. Did that make the ability to hold a grudge a survival factor?
I tried to follow what you were saying, but I couldn't. What happened to Nessus?
My big mouth. I scared him. Now how are we going to find you?
Can't you tell where I am?
Nessus has the only locator, probably for the same reason he saw to it that we didn't know how to operate the emergency thrust.
I wondered about that, said Teela.
He wanted to be sure he could run away from an angry Kazin. Never mind that. How much did you understand?
Not much. You kept asking each other why I wanted to come here. Louis, I didn't. I came with you, because I love you.
Louis nodded. Sure, if Teela needed to come to the Ring World, she had had to have a motive to ride with Louis Wu. It was hardly flattering. She loved him for the sake of her own luck. Once he had thought she loved him for himself.
I'm passing over a city, Teela said suddenly. I can see some lights, not many.
There must have been a big, durable power source. Speaker could probably find it on his map. Is it worth looking at?
I told you there are lights. Maybe...
The sound went off without a click, without a warning. Louis considered the empty space above his dashboard. Then he called... Nessus? There was no response. Louis activated the siren. Nessus came out of it like a family of snakes in a burning zoo. Under other circumstances, it would have been funny, the two necks frantically untangling, posing like two question marks above the dashboard. Then Nessus barking, Louis, what is it? Speaker had answered the call instantly. Apparently sitting at attention, he waited for instructions and enlightenment. Something's happened to Teela.
Good,
said Nessus, and the heads withdrew. Grimly, Louis flicked the siren off, waited a moment, flipped it on again. Nessus reacted as before. This time Louis spoke first. If we don't find out what happened to Teela, I'll kill you, he said.
I have the TASP, said Nessus. We designed it to work equally well on Kazinti and human. You've seen its effect on Speaker.
Do you think it would stop me from killing you?
Yes, Louis, I do.
What, Louis asked carefully, will you bet? The puppeteer considered.
To rescue Teela can hardly be as dangerous as to take that gamble. I had forgotten that she is your mate.
He glanced down.
She no longer registers on my locator. I cannot tell where she is.
Does that mean her cycle's been damaged?
Yes, extensively. The sender was near one thruster unit of her fly cycle. Perhaps she ran afoul of another working machine, kin to the one which burned our communicator disks.
But you know where she was when she dropped out of the conversation?
10 degrees of spinward to port. I do not know the distance, but we can estimate this from the speed tolerances of her fly cycle.
They flew 10 degrees to port of spinward, a slanting line across Speaker's hand-drawn map. For 2 hours there had been no lights, and Louis had begun to wonder if they were lost. 3,500 miles from the rolling hurricane that was the eye storm, the line across Speaker's map ended at a seaport. Beyond the seaport was a bay the size of the Atlantic Ocean. Teela couldn't have flown further than that. The seaport would be their last chance. Suddenly, beyond the crest of a deceptively gradual slope of hill, there were lights.
Pull up,
Louis whispered fiercely, not knowing why he whispered. But Speaker had already stopped them in midair. They hovered, studying the lights and the terrain. The terrain. City. City everywhere. Below, shadowy in the blue archlight, were houses like beehives with rounded windows, separated by curved sidewalks too narrow to be called streets. Ahead, more of the same, and then taller buildings further on, until all was skyscrapers and floaters.
They built differently, Louis whispered. The architecture, it's not like Zignamu Click-Click. Different styles.
Skyscrapers, said Speaker. With so much room on the Ring World, why build so tall?
To prove they can do it.
No, that's asinine, said Louis. There'd be no point if they could build something like the Ring World itself.
Perhaps the tall buildings came later during the decline of civilization. The lights, blazing white tiers of windows, a dozen isolated towers blazing from crown to base.
They were clustered in what Louis already thought of as the Civic Center, because all six of the floating buildings were there. One thing more. A small suburban patch to spinward of the Civic Center glowed dim orange-white. On the second floor of one of the Beehive houses, the three sat in a triangle around Speaker's map. Speaker had insisted that they bring the fly cycles inside with them. Security. Their light came from the headlamps of Speaker's own cycle, reflected and softened by a curved wall. A table, oddly sculpted to form plates and coaster depressions, had toppled and smashed to dust when Louis brushed against it. Dust was an inch thick on the floor. The paint on the curved wall had crumbled and settled in a soft ridge of sky-blue dust along the baseboard. Louis felt the age of the city settling on him.
"When the map room tapes were made, this was one of the largest of Ringworld cities," Speaker said.
His crescent claw moved across the map.
"The original city was a planned city, a semicircle with its flat side along the sea. The tower called Heaven must have been built much later, when the city had already spread wings far along the coast."
"Pity you didn't draw a map of it," said Louis. For all that showed on Speaker's map was a shaded semicircle. Speaker picked up the map and folded it.
"Such an abandoned metropolis must hold many secrets. We must be wary here. If civilization can rise in all this land, on this structure, then it must be where clues point the way to vanished technology."
"What of vanished metals?" Nessus objected. "A fallen civilization could not rise again on the Ring World. There are no metals to mine, no fossil fuels. Tools would be restricted to wood and bone."
"We saw lights."
"The pattern seemed random, a result of many self-contained power sources failing one by one." "But you may be right," said Nessus. "If tool building has resumed in this place, we must contact the tool builders, but on our own terms."
"We may already have been located by our intercom emissions."
"No, Speaker. Our intercom emissions are closed beams."
Louis, half listening, thought, "She could be hurt. She could be lying somewhere, unable to move, waiting for us." And he couldn't make himself believe it.
It seemed that Teela had run afoul of some old Ringworld machine, perhaps a sophisticated automatic weapon, if the Ringworlders had such things. Conceivably, it had zapped only her intercom and locator sender, leaving the motive systems intact. But it seemed improbable. Then why couldn't he work up a sense of urgency? Louis Wu, cool as a computer while his woman faced unknown peril. His woman. Yes, but something more, and something different. How stupid of Nessus to assume that a bred-for-luck human would think like the humans he was used to. Would a lucky puppeteer think like, say, the sane puppeteer Chiron? Maybe fear was in a puppeteer's genes. But in human beings, fear had to be learned. Nessus was saying, "We must assume a momentary failure of Teela's sporadic luck. Under that assumption, Teela is not injured." "What?" Louis was jolted. The puppeteer seemed to have paralleled his own thinking. "A failure of her fly cycle would probably leave her dead. If she were not killed instantly, then she must have been rescued as soon as her luck resumed its power."
"That's ridiculous. You can't expect a psychic power to follow rules like that."
"The logic is impeccable, Louis. My point is that Teela does not need rescue immediately. If alive, she can wait. We can wait for morning to spy out the land."
"Then what? How do we find her?"
"She is in safe hands if her luck held. We search for those hands. If there are no hands, we will know that tomorrow, and we can hope she will signal us. There are various ways she can do that."
Speaker broke in. "But they all use light."
"And if they do?"
"They do. I have considered this. It is possible that her headlamps still function. If so, she will have left them on. You claim she is intelligent, Louis."
"She is."
"And she has no regard for security. She would not care what found her, so long as we found her. If her headlamps are dead, she might use her flashlight laser to signal anything that moves, or to start a signal fire."
"And what you're saying is that we can't find her in daylight."
"And you're right," Louis admitted.
Nessus said,
First, we must explore the city by daylight. If we find citizens, well and good. Otherwise, we may search for Teela tomorrow night.
You'd leave her lying somewhere for 30 hours? You cold-blooded... Townshit, that patch of light we saw could be her. Not street lamps, but burning buildings.
Speaker stood up. True, we must investigate.
I am hindmost to this fleet. I say that Teela's value does not match the risk of a night flight over an alien city.
Speaker to Animals had mounted his fly cycle. We are in territory which may be hostile. Thereby, I command. We will go to seek Teela Brown, a member of our company.
The Kazin lifted off, eased his fly cycle through a great oval window. Beyond the window were fragments of a porch, then the suburbs of an unnamed city. The other fly cycles were on the ground floor. Louis descended the stairwell hurriedly but with care, as part of the stairs had collapsed, and the escalator machinery had long since turned to rust.
Nessus looked down at him over the rim of the stairwell. I stay here, Louis. I consider this mutiny.
Louis did not answer. His fly cycle rose, edged through the oval doorway, and angled up into the night. The night was cool. Archlight painted the city in navy blue shadows. Louis found the gleam of Speaker's cycle and followed it toward the glowing section of suburb to spinward of the brilliantly lighted civic center. It was all city, hundreds of square miles of city. There weren't even parks. With all the room on the Ringworld, why build so close? Even on Earth, men valued their elbow room. But Earth had transfer booths. That must be it. The Ringworlders had valued travel time more than elbow room.
We stay low, said Speaker via intercom. If the lights of the suburbs are mere street lighting, we return to Nessus. We must not risk the possibility that Teela was shot down.
Right, said Louis. But he thought, listen to him, worrying about security in the face of a purely hypothetical enemy. A Kazin, sanely reckless, looked cautious as a puppeteer next to Teela Brown. Where was she now? Well, or hurt, or dead? They had been searching for civilized Ringworlders since before the Lyre crashed. Had they finally found them? That chance was probably what had kept Nessus from deserting Teela entirely. Louis's threat meant nothing, as Nessus must well be aware. If they had found civilized Ringworlders as enemies, well, that was hardly unexpected. His cycle was drifting to the left. Louis corrected.
Louis.
Speaker to Animals seemed to be wrestling something.
There seems to be interference.
Then, urgently, with the practiced whip of command in his voice,
Louis, turn back, now!
The Kazin's command voice seemed to speak directly to Louis's hindbrain. Louis turned immediately. His fly cycle, however, went straight. Louis threw all his weight on the steering bar. No good. The cycle continued moving toward the lights of the civic center.
Something's got us, Louis shouted.
And with that, the terror had him. They were puppets. Huge and dark and sentient, the puppet master twitched their arms and legs and moved them about to an unseen script. And Louis Wu knew the puppet master's name. The Luck of Teela Brown.
Chapter 19. In the Trap. Speaker, being more practical, flipped the emergency siren. The multiple frequency scream went on and on. Louis wondered if the puppeteer would answer at all. The boy who cried wolf? But Nessus was crying, yes, yes, with the volume too loud. Of course, he'd had to get downstairs first.
We are under attack, Speaker told him. Some agency is flying our vehicles by remote control. Have you suggestions?
He couldn't tell what Nessus was thinking. His lips, twice too many, loose and broad and knobbed to serve as fingers, moved continually but without meaning. Would the puppeteer be able to help, or would he panic?
Turn your intercoms about to give me a view of your path. Are either of you hurt?
No, but we are stuck, said Louis. We can't jump. We're too high, moving too fast. We're headed straight for the civic center.
For what?
The cluster of lighted buildings, remember?
Yes.
The puppeteer seemed to consider.
A bandit signal must be overriding the signals from your instruments. Speaker, I want readings from your dashboard.
Speaker read off while he and Louis drew ever closer to the lights of the central city. At one point, Louis interrupted. We're passing that patch of suburbia with the street lights.
Are they indeed street lights?
Yes and no. All the oval doors of the houses glow bright orange. It's peculiar. I think it's honest street lighting, but the power's been dimmed and cooled by time.
I concur, said Speaker to Animals.
I hate to nag, but we're getting closer. I think we're headed for the big building in the middle.
I see it. The double cone with lights only in the top half.
That's the one.
Louis, let us try to interfere with the bandit signal. Slave your cycle to mine.
Louis activated the slave circuit. His cycle slammed hard up against him as if he'd been booted in the butt by a giant foot. An instant later, the power cut off entirely. Crash balloons exploded before and behind him. They were shaped balloons, and they interlocked around him like a pair of clasped hands. Louis could not so much as move his hands or turn his head. He was falling.
I'm falling, he reported.
His hand, pressed against the dashboard by the balloons, still touched the slave circuit. Louis waited another moment, still hoping the slave circuit would take hold. But the beehive houses were coming too close. Louis shifted back to manual. Nothing happened. He was still falling. With a calm that was sheer braggadocio, Louis said, Speaker, don't try the slave circuit. It doesn't work. And because they could see his face, he waited with his face immobile and his eyes open. Waited for the ring world to slap him dead. Deceleration came suddenly, pushing hard upward on the cycle. The cycle turned over, leaving Louis Wu head down under 5 G's of pull. He fainted. When he came to, he was still head down, held by the pressure of the crash balloons. His head was pounding. He saw a hazy, crazy vision of the puppet master cursing and trying to get his strings untangled, while the puppet Louis Wu dangled head down over the stage. The floating building was short and wide and ornate. Its lower half was an inverted cone. As the fly cycles approached it, a horizontal slit slid open and swallowed them. They were passing into the dark interior when Speaker's fly cycle, which had been edging closer to Louis, quietly turned over. Balloons exploded around Speaker before he could fall. Louis scowled in sour satisfaction. He had been miserable long enough to appreciate the company. Nessus was saying,
Your inverted attitude implies that you are being supported by fields electromagnetic in nature. Such fields would support metal, but not protoplasm, with the result...
Louis wiggled against his confinement, but not too hard. He would fall if he wriggled free of the balloons. Behind him, the door slid shut, just faster than Louis's eyes could adjust to the dark. He saw nothing of the interior. He couldn't guess how far down the floor might be. He heard Nessa say,
Can you reach it with your hand?
And Speaker,
Yes, if I can push between the... Yeah, you were right, the casing is hot.
Then your motor has been burnt out. Your fly cycles are inert, dead.
Fortunate that my saddle is shielded from the heat.
We can hardly be surprised if the ringworlders were adept at harnessing electromagnetic forces. So many other tools were denied them. Hyperdrive, thrusters, induced gravity.
Louis had been straining to see something, anything. He could turn his head slowly, his cheek scraping against the balloon surface, but there was no light anywhere. Moving his arms against the pressure, he felt across the dashboard until he thought he had found the headlight switch. Why he expected it to work, he could not have said. The beams went out tight and white and bounced dimly back from a distant curved wall. A dozen vehicles hung about him, all at the same level. There were packages no larger than a racing jet backpack, and others as large as flying cars. There was even a kind of flying truck with a transparent hull. Within the maze of floating junk, a fly cycle held Speaker to Animals upside down. The Kazin's bald head and hairy orange mask protruded below the shaped crash balloons, and one clawed hand had been pushed forcefully out to touch the side of the cycle.
Good, said Nessus. Light. I was about to suggest that. Do you both understand the implication? Every electrical and electromagnetic circuit in your vehicle has been burnt out, provided it was working when you were attacked. Speaker's vehicle, and presumably yours, Louis, was attacked again as you entered the building.
Which is pretty clearly a prison, Louis forced out. His head felt like a water balloon being filled too full, and he had trouble speaking. But he couldn't let the others do all the work, even if the work was only speculating on alien technology while hanging head down. And if it's a prison, he went on, then why isn't there a third zap gun in here with us, in case we should happen to have working weapons, which we do?
There unquestionably is one, said Nessus. Your headlamps prove that the third zap gun is not working. The zap guns are clearly automatic. Otherwise, someone would be guarding you. It would be safe for Speaker to use the slaver digging tool.
That's good news, Louis said, except that I've been hanging around.
He and Speaker were floating upside down in an airborne Sargasso Sea. Of three archaic flying jetpacks, one was still occupied. The skeleton was small but human. Not a trace of skin remained on the white bones. The clothing must have been good, for shreds of it still survived. Brightly colored rags, including a tattered yellow cloak that hung straight down from the point of the flyer's jaw. The other packs were empty, but the bones had to be somewhere. Louis forced his head back, back. The basement of the police building was a wide, dim, conical pit. Around the wall were concentric rings of cells. The doors were trapdoors above the cells. There were radial stairways leading down to the pit at the apex. In and around the pit were the bones Louis was searching for, shining dimly back at him from far below. He couldn't wonder that one man in a ruined flying pack had been afraid to turn himself loose. But others, trapped here in cars and backpacks, had preferred the long fall to death by thirst. Louis said,
I don't see what Speaker is supposed to use the slaver disintegrator on.
I have been thinking about that very seriously.
If he blows a hole in the wall, it doesn't help us. Likewise, the ceiling, which he can't reach anyway. If he hits the generator for the field holding us here, we fall 90 feet to the floor. But if he doesn't, we'll be here until we starve, or until we give up and turn ourselves loose. Then we fall 90 feet to the floor.
Yes.
That's all? Just yes?
I need more data. Will one of you please describe what you see around you? I see only part of a curved wall.
They took turns describing the conical cell block, what they could see of it in the dim point source light. Speaker turned on his own lights, and that helped. But when Louis ran out of things to say, he was still trapped, upside down, without food or water, hanging above a lethal drop. Louis felt a bubble scream somewhere inside him, buried deep and well under control, but rising. Soon it would be near the surface. And he wondered if Nessus would leave them. That was bad. It was a question with an obvious answer. There was every reason why the puppeteer should leave, and no reason why he should not. Unless he still hoped to find civilized natives here.
The floating vehicles and the age of the skeletons both indicate that there's nobody tending the machinery of the cell block, Speaker speculated. The fields that trapped us must have collected a few vehicles after the city was deserted. But then there were no more vehicles on the ring world, so the machines still work because nothing has strained their powers in so long a time.
That may be so, said Nessus. But someone is monitoring our conversation.
Louis felt his ears prick up. He saw Speaker's fan out.
It must have required excellent technique to tap a closed beam. One wonders if the eavesdropper has a translator.
What can you tell about him?
Only his direction. The source of the interference is your own present whereabouts. Perhaps the eavesdropper is above you.
Reflexively, Louis tried to look up. Not a prayer. He was head down with two crash balloons and the fly cycle between him and the ceiling. We've found the Ringworld civilization, he said aloud.
Perhaps. I think a civilized being could have repaired the third zap gun, as you called it. But the main thing... let me think.
And the puppeteer went off into Beethoven or the Beatles or something classical sounding. For all Louis could tell, he was making it up as he went along. And when he said, "Let me think," he meant it. The whistling went on and on. Louis was getting thirsty and hungry, and his head was pounding. He had given up hope several separate times when the puppeteer came on again.
"I would have preferred to use the slaver disintegrator, but it is not to be. Louis, you will have to do it. You are primate descended, better than speaker at climbing. You will secure the..."
"Climbing?"
"When I finish, you may ask questions, Louis. Secure the flashlight laser from wherever you put it. Use the beam to puncture the balloon in front of you. You will have to snatch at its fabric as you fall. Use it to climb over the fly cycle until you are balanced on top. Then..."
"You're out of your mind!"
"Let me finish, Louis. The purpose of all this activity is to destroy the zap gun, as you call it. Probably there are two zap guns. One is over the door as you entered by or under it. The other may be anywhere. Your only clue may be that it looks like the first zap gun."
"Sure, and it may not. Never mind that. How do you expect me to grab at the fabric of an exploding balloon fast enough to..." "No, I can't."
"Louis, how can I reach you if a weapon waits to burn out my machinery?"
"I don't know."
"Do you expect Speaker to do the climbing?"
"Can't cats climb?" Speaker said, "My ancestors were plains cats, Louis. My burnt hand is healing slowly. I cannot climb. In any case, the leaf-eater's proposition is insane. Surely you see that he is merely looking for an excuse to desert us." Louis saw. Perhaps he let the fear show.
"I will not leave you yet," Nessus said. "I will wait. Perhaps you will conceive a better plan. Perhaps the eavesdropper will show himself. I will wait."
Louis Wu, wedged upside down and motionless between two shaped balloons, naturally found it difficult to measure time. Nothing changed. Nothing moved. He could hear Nessus whistling in the distance, but nothing else seemed to be happening. Eventually, Louis started counting his own heartbeats. 72 to the minute, he figured. Precisely 10 minutes later, he was heard to say, 72. One... what am I doing?"
"Were you speaking to me, Louis?"
"Tangit. Speaker, I can't take this. I'd rather die now than go crazy first." He began forcing his arms down.
"I command, Louis, under combat conditions. I order you to remain calm and wait."
"Sorry." Louis forced his arms down. Relax. Jerk down. Relax. There it was. His belt. His hand was too far forward. He forced his elbow back. Relax. Jerk back.
"What the puppeteer suggests is suicide, Louis."
"Maybe." He had it, the flashlight laser. Two more jerks freed it from his belt and pointed it forward. He would burn into the dashboard, but would not burn himself. He fired. The balloon collapsed slowly. As it did, the one at his back pushed him forward into the dashboard. Under the lighter pressure, it was easy to push the flashlight laser into his belt and to clutch two handfuls of wrinkling, collapsing fabric. He was also sliding out of his seat. Faster, faster. He gripped with manic force, and when he turned over, falling, his hands did not slip on the fabric. He hung by his hands beneath his fly cycle, with a 90-foot drop below, and...
"Speaker!" "Here I am, Louis. I've secured my own weapon. Shall I pop the other balloon for you?"
"Yes."
It was right across his path, blocking him entirely. The balloon did not collapse. One side of it puffed dust for 2 seconds, then disappeared in a great puff of air. Speaker had zapped it with one beam of the disintegrator.
"Finnegal knows how you can aim that thing," Louis wheezed.
He began to climb.
It was easy going while the fabric held out. Translate... despite the hours he'd spent with blood flowing to his brain, Louis managed not to let go. But the fabric ended in the vicinity of the foot throttle, and the cycle had rolled half over with his weight so that he still hung from underneath. He pulled himself close against the cycle, braced himself with his knees. He began to rock. Speaker to animals was making curious sounds. The cycle rocked back and forth, further with each swing. Louis assumed, because he had to, that most of the metal was in the belly of the cycle. Otherwise, the cycle would roll, and wherever he placed himself, Louis would be underneath, and therefore Nessus would not have made the suggestion. The cycle rolled far. Louis, nauseated, fought the urge to vomit. If his breathing passages got clogged now, it was all over. The cycle rolled back and over and was precisely upside down. Louis lunged across the underside and snatched at the other end of the collapsed balloon. And had it. The cycle continued its roll. Louis was flattened, chest down, across the belly of the machine. He waited, clinging. The inert hulk paused, hesitated, rolled back. His vestibular canals spun, and Louis lost, what, yesterday's late lunch? He lost it explosively in great agonizing heaves across the metal and across his sleeve, but he didn't shift his position more than an inch. The fly cycle continued to heave like the sea, but Louis was anchored. Presently, he dared to look up. A woman was watching him. She seemed to be entirely bald. Her face reminded Louis of the wire sculpture in the banquet hall of the Heaven Tower. The features and the expression. She was as calm as a goddess or a dead woman, and he wanted to blush or hide or disappear. Instead, he said, "Speaker, we're being watched. Relay to Nessus."
"A minute, Louis. I'm discomposed. I made the mistake of watching you climb."
"Okay. She's, I thought she was bald, but she isn't. There's a fringe of hair-bearing scalp that crosses over her ears and meets at the base of her skull. She wears the hair long, more than shoulder length." He did not say that her hair was rich and dark, falling past one shoulder as she bent slightly forward to watch Louis woo, nor that her skull was finely and delicately shaped, nor that her eyes seemed to spear him like a martini olive. "I think she's an engineer. She either belongs to the same race or follows the same customs. Have you got that?"
"Yes. How can you climb so? It seemed that you defied gravity. What are you, Louis?"
Clutching himself to his dead fly cycle, Louis laughed. It seemed to take all his strength. "You're a cadaptist," he said. "Admit it."
"I was raised so, but the teachings did not take."
"Sure they didn't. Have you got Nessus?"
"Yes, I used the siren."
"Relay this. She's about 20 feet from me. She's watching me like a snake. I don't mean she's intensely interested in me. I mean she's not interested in anything else at all. She blinks, but she never looks away. She's sitting in some kind of booth. There used to be glass or something in 3 of the walls, but that's gone, leaving not much more than some stairs and a platform. She's sitting with her legs over the edge. It must have been a way of watching the prisoners. She's dressed in, well, I can't say I go for the style, knee-length and elbow-length overalls ballooning out."
"But aliens wouldn't be interested in that."
"The fabric is artificial, obviously, and either it's new or it's self-cleaning and very durable. She..." Louis interrupted himself because the girl had said something. He waited. She repeated it, whatever it was, a short sentence. Then she stood gracefully and went up the stairs.
"She's gone," said Louis. "Probably lost interest."
"Perhaps she went back to her listening devices."
"Probably right." "If there was an eavesdropper in the building, Occam's razor said it was her."
"Nessus asks you to focus your flashlight laser to low and wide, and to be seen using it for lighting when next the woman appears. I am not to show the slaver weapon. The woman could probably kill us both by turning off a switch. She must not see us with weapons."
"Then how can we get rid of the zap guns?"
A moment before Speaker relayed the answer. "We do not. Nessus says that he will try something else. He is coming here."
Louis let his head sag against the metal. The relief he felt was so great that he didn't even question it, until Speaker said,
"He will only have us all in the same trap. Louis, how can I dissuade him?"
"Tell him so. No, don't even do that. If he didn't know it was safe, he'd stay away.
How can it be safe?
I don't know. Let me rest. The puppeteer must know what he was doing. He could trust Nessus's cowardice. Louis rubbed his cheek against the smooth, cool metal. He dozed. He was never less than marginally aware of where he was. If his cycle stirred or shifted, he came wide-eyed out of sleep, clutching metal in his knees and fabric in his fists. His sleep was a running nightmare. When light flashed through his eyelids, he came awake immediately. Daylight poured through the horizontal slit that had served them as a doorway. Within that glare, Nessus's fly cycle was a black silhouette. The fly cycle was upside down, and so was the puppeteer, held by seat webbing rather than crash balloons. The slit closed behind him.
"Welcome," said Speaker, slurring the words. "Can you turn me upright?"
"Not yet. Has the girl reappeared?"
"No."
"She will. Humans are curious, Speaker. She cannot have seen members of our species before."
"What of it? I want to be right side up," Speaker moaned.
The puppeteer did something to his dashboard. A miracle happened. His fly cycle turned over. Louis said one word.
"How?"
"I turned everything off after I knew that the bandit signal had my controls. If the lifting field had not caught me, I could have turned on my motors before I struck pavement. Now," the puppeteer said briskly, "the next step should be easy. When the girl appears, act friendly. Louis, you may attempt to have sex with her if you think you might succeed. Speaker, Louis is to be our master. We are to be his servitors. The woman may be xenophobic. It would lull her to believe that a human being commands these aliens."
Louis actually laughed. Somehow the nightmarish half-sleep had rested him.
"I doubt she'll be feeling friendly, let alone seductive. You didn't see her. She's as cold as the black caves of Pluto, at least where I'm concerned, and I can't really blame her."
She had watched him lose his lunch across his sleeve, generally an unromantic sight. The puppeteer said,
"She will be feeling happy whenever she looks at us. She will cease to feel happy when she tries to leave us. If she brings one of us closer to her, her joy will increase."
"Tangit, yes," cried Louis.
"You see, good. In addition, I have been practicing the Ringworld language. I believe my pronunciation is correct, and my grammar. If I only knew what more of the words meant."
Speaker had stopped complaining long ago. Inverted above a lethal drop, with burns all over him and one hand charred to the bone, he had raged at Louis and Nessus for being unable to help him. But he had been quiet for hours now. In the dim light, Louis dozed. In his sleep, he heard bells and woke. She tinkled as she came down the steps. There were bells on her moccasins. Her garment was different, too, a top-shaped, high-necked dress fitted with half a dozen big bulging pockets. Her long black hair fell forward over one shoulder. The serene dignity in her face had not changed. She sat down with her feet over the edge of the platform, and she watched Louis Wu. She did not shift position, neither did Louis. For several minutes they held each other's eyes. Then she reached into one of the big pockets and produced something fist-sized and orange. She tossed it toward Louis, aiming it so that it would go past him, a few inches beyond his reach. He recognized it as it went by, a knobby, juicy fruit he had found on a bush 2 days ago. He had dropped several of them into the intake hopper of his kitchen without tasting them. The fruit splattered red across the roof of a cell. Suddenly, Louis's mouth was trying to water, and he was taken with a raging thirst. She tossed him another. It came closer this time. He could have touched it if he had tried, but he would also have overturned the cycle. And she knew it. Her third shot tapped his shoulder. He clung to his two fistfuls of balloon and thought black thoughts. Then Nessus's fly cycle drifted into view. And she smiled. The puppeteer had been floating behind the truck-sized derelict. Upside down again, he drifted obliquely toward the viewing platform as if wafted there by a stray-induced current, and as he passed Louis, he asked, "Can you seduce her?" Louis snarled.
Then, realizing that the puppeteer really wasn't mocking him, he said, "I think she thinks I'm an animal. Forget it."
"Then we need different tactics."
Louis rubbed his forehead against the cool metal. He had seldom felt so miserable. "You're in charge," he said. "She won't buy me as an equal, but she might buy you. She won't see you as competition. You're too alien." The puppeteer had drifted past him. Now he said something in what sounded to Louis like the language of the shaven choir-leading priest, the holy language of the engineers. The girl did not respond, but she wasn't smiling exactly, but the corners of her mouth did seem to turn up slightly, and there was more animation in her eyes. Nessus must be using low power, very low power. He spoke again, and this time she answered. Her voice was cool and musical, and if she sounded imperious to Louis Wu, he was predisposed to hear that quality. The puppeteer's voice became identical to the girl's. What developed then was a language lesson. To Louis Wu, uneasily balanced over a lethal drop, it was bound to be dull. He picked up a word here and there. At one point she tossed Nessus one of the fist-sized orange fruits, and they established that it was a thrum, and Nessus kept it. Suddenly she stood up and left. Louis said, "Well?"
"She must have become bored," said Nessus. "She gave no warning."
"I'm dying of thirst. Could I have that thrum?"
"Thrum is the color of the peel, Louis."
He edged his cycle alongside Louis and handed him the fruit. Louis was only just desperate enough to free one hand. That meant he had to bite through the thick peel and tear it away with his teeth. At some point he reached real fruit and bit into it. It was the best thing he had tasted in 200 years. When he had quite finished the fruit, he asked, "Is she coming back?"
"We may hope so. I used the TASP at low power that it might affect her below the conscious level. She will miss it. The lure will become stronger every time she sees me. Louis, should we not make her fall in love with you?"
"Forget it. She thinks I'm a native, a savage. Which brings up the question, what is she?"
"I could not say. She did not try to hide it, but it did not come across either. I do not know enough language. Not yet."
Chapter 20. Meet. Nessus had landed to explore the dimness below. Cut off from the intercom, Louis tried to watch what the puppeteer was doing. Eventually, he gave that up. Much later, he heard footsteps. No bells this time. He cupped his hands and shouted downward. "Nessus!" The sound bounced off the walls and focused itself horrendously in the apex of the cone. The puppeteer jumped to his feet, swarmed aboard his cycle, and took off. Cast off, more likely. No doubt he had left the motor going to hold the cycle down against the trapping field. Now he simply cut the motor. He was back among the hovering metal when the footsteps stopped somewhere above him.
"What the tonge is she doing?" Louis whispered. "Patience. You could not expect her to be conditioned by one exposure to a TASP at low power."
"Try to get it into your thick, brainless heads. I cannot keep my balance indefinitely."
"You must. How can I help?"
"Water," said Louis, with a tongue like 2 yards of flannel rolled up.
"Are you thirsty? But how can I get water to you? If you turn your head, you may lose your balance."
"I know. Forget it." Louis shuddered. Strange that Louis Wu, the spacer, should be so afraid of heights. "House Speaker."
"I fear for him, Louis. He has been unconscious for uncomfortably long."
"Tonge, tonge." Footsteps. She must have a mania for changing clothes, Louis thought. What she wore now was all overlapping pleats in orange and green. Like previous garments, it showed nothing at all of her shape. She knelt at the edge of the observation platform, coolly watching them. Louis clutched his metal raft and waited for developments. He saw her soften. Her eyes went dreamy. The corners of her small mouth turned up. Nessus spoke. She seemed to consider. She said something that might have been an answer. Then she left them. "Well?"
"We shall see.
I get so sick of waiting." Suddenly, the puppeteer's fly cycle was floating upward. Up and forward. It bumped against the edge of the observation platform like a rowboat making dock. Nessus stepped daintily ashore. The girl came to greet him. What she held in her left hand had to be a weapon. But with her other hand, she touched the puppeteer.